If only life had a remote control, you could pause or rewind. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the 1-minute risk test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The Supreme Court hears oral arguments in two big cases, one on a judge-made constitutional right to homeless camping, and the other that could limit the power of union complaints to strong-arm businesses into settlements. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We are joined today by my colleagues, columnists Alicia Finley and Kim Strassel. Let's start with the argument at the Supreme Court on Monday. That one was City of Grants Pass, Oregon, versus Johnson. Grants Pass is a town of about 38,000 people that is being blocked by the federal courts from enforcing its ban on homeless encampments. And here is a piece of what it says in its brief to the justices. The Eighth Amendment's cruel and unusual punishments clause prohibits certain methods of punishment, those that are cruel and unusual, but the Ninth Circuit has held that the clause forbids governments from imposing any punishment, not fines, not short jail terms, not anything, for camping on public property when such conduct flows from the purported status of being involuntarily homeless. And here is the reply from Gloria Johnson and John Logan, two homeless residents of Grants Pass. They say the challenged ordinances are not camping regulations in any ordinary sense of the word. By design, they define camping so expansively that it is physically impossible for someone without access to shelter to live in Grants Pass without risking punishment. Alicia, what do you make of this case and the argument that the judges heard on Monday?
So this case actually expands on another case that was also determined in the Ninth Circuit that involved the city of Boise, Idaho, that was known as Martin. And the Supreme Court essentially extended the logic there that it is, quote unquote, cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment to enforce any kind of laws that ban camping on public streets and property. In this case, it extended it to criminal sanctions rather than merely civil fines or civil sanctions, and also added that the way to determine if somebody is, quote unquote, involuntarily homeless, if the number of people who are on the streets exceed the number of available beds. And here, the Ninth Circuit hilariously determined that beds at religious shelters like Salvation Army or those really don't count as available beds because that would violate the Establishment Clause of the Constitution and the Supreme Court's Lemon Test, requiring a strict separation between church and state. So those beds don't count as available. Neither do any kind of space in warming shelters like during the winter, because well, those are only really open during the winter, nor any place in sobering centers. So places where people would be required to stay sober, not use drugs or alcohol. Those aren't available because they would require people to change their behaviors. I cannot understate how radical this ruling is. And to emphasize and stress that, almost all major cities on the West Coast and in the Ninth Circuit jurisdiction weighed in with friend of court's brief saying that this is severely impairing our ability to enforce public order and to keep our streets clean.
Let's listen to a piece of the oral argument. First, here is Chief Justice John Roberts asking a question to the attorney for Grants Pass, Theani Evangelis.
What will the city do if you don't prevail here?
The city's hands will be tied. It will be forced to surrender its public spaces as it has been. Unfortunately, beds are going unused at the Gospel Rescue Mission. People are not getting the help that they need. The city is under an injunction here, and it's unable to rely on these basic ordinances. And the Ninth Circuit's decisions give cities like Grants Pass no guidance about how they can navigate this very challenging area. The Ninth Circuit has effectively imposed a municipal code under the Ninth Circuit's Martin rule to regulate what the city can do in its public spaces.
And here's that same attorney tangling with Justice Sonia Sotomayor.
We think that it is harmful for people to be living in public spaces, on streets and in parks, whatever bedding materials, when humans are living in those conditions. We think that that's not compassionate and that
oh, it's
no
not, but neither
that.
Is
we
neither
don't.
Is providing them with nothing.
Well,
to alleviate that situation.
This is a difficult policy question, Justice Sotomayor. It is.
Where do we put them if every city, every village, every town lacks compassion and passes a law identical to this? Where are they supposed to sleep? Are they supposed to kill themselves not sleeping?
So this is a necessity defense, as I mentioned, under Oregon law, is available. States are able to address these concerns. This is a complicated policy question.
Kim, I guess I come out sort of where that attorney does, that maybe this is a question for people in those cities, for people in those states. What is the best way to deal with the problem of homelessness? But I find myself scratching my head trying to figure out how Justice Sotomayor thinks that that's going to be decided by these 9 judges at the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things to address here. I mean, first of all, I just would like to drill into the illogic of what Sonia Sotomayor was saying there when she's saying there's no place to go. And I want to underline one thing that Alicia said when she was making the point about how radical this is that to believe the argument that's being put forward by advocates for the homeless, you have to actually buy into that argument that this is entirely an involuntary state and that there really is no options. But as Alicia pointed out, and as the attorney pointed out for Grants Pass, there are beds available. There are lots of beds available. When people say that the homeless should be able to have a place to stay, we need to be very clear about what they're actually saying. They're saying they should have a bed, but they should also not be subject to any rules whatsoever. They shouldn't have to be asked to deal with a drug or alcohol abuse situation. They shouldn't have to be asked to maybe take part in a program that would try to get them back on track into regular housing with a job. They should be able to just simply either have that bed or camp on the street, no matter what kind of consequences there are for the broader community. So that's one argument, which is just simply the fallacy of the claim that this is involuntary, because it also doesn't get to the fact that there are many people who prefer to not go into shelters. They want to be living on the street. And that is something that the homeless community has long told us that we're meant to respect, the fact that if they don't want to be housed, then why should they have to be housed? The question then becomes, why should the rest of the community have to have them on public property when there are other alternatives? But you bring up another question, Kyle, which was a big focus of many of the justices and the questions, which was the complexity of this and also the dueling obligations of city officials. There are lots of things that money must be spent on in the name of civil society, and many of them are also very important too. Justice John Roberts said, are we really going to make the decision here at the Supreme Court about whether or not a community like Grants Pass has to spend its money on more shelter beds, or whether or not it's going to fix its lead pipe problem? I mean, I'm not saying Grants Pass has one, but for example, or give out food assistance to people, or for instance, more healthcare dollars. So it's a very complex question also about who decides how many beds there are and how does that work? And that I think the Supreme Court, in some ways, just at a very broad level, many of the justices were pointing out the ridiculousness of the notion that 9 people sitting in Washington can sort out the homeless situation in a place like Grants Pass.
Hang tight, we'll be right back in a minute.
If only life had a remote control, you could pause or rewind. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the 1-minute risk test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
Welcome back. A couple other thoughts that I would throw out here. Here is the full text of the 8th Amendment. Excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. And so the idea that you can read into that some sort of prohibition on making camping in public illegal if there is not a certain number of shelter beds defined in a certain way, it strikes me as pretty atextual. And I get that not everyone on the Supreme Court is a textualist first, but it seems to me that a majority of those justices probably are. Another is that my understanding is that these kinds of laws, Alicia, are often used as a way of giving cities some leverage to get people into drug treatment programs and so forth. If, as Kim described before the break, they don't want to do that, if they kind of like being on the streets and they don't want to quit using whatever substances they might be abusing, these kinds of ordinances are one way to get them the help that they need instead of just allowing them to continue existing on the streets or in public parks. Another thought, and Alicia, you mentioned this a minute ago, is the remarkable cross-partisan support here for Grants Pass's position, the mayor of San Francisco, I think Governor Gavin Newsom, California's governor, who is no conservative, has been backing up Grants Pass here. But there is a brief by a different set of states. This is Maryland, Illinois, Massachusetts, Minnesota, New York, and Vermont, another set of blue states that is going against Grants Pass. And they make kind of a fascinating argument, which is that this is not really a restriction on the ability of cities to deal with the homeless problem, because they argue, Alicia, that cities could restrict the sites of encampments, they could limit fires and so forth, they could provide security for these places. And then they have this line: a town near Sacramento gives camp residents $20 gift cards in return for bagging their trash, saving the town thousands in public cleaning costs while maintaining a working relationship between the residents and town authorities. And so, kind of an amazing argument to my eye, Alicia. They're saying that Grants Pass is just not being creative enough in trying to solve this homelessness problem.
Well, I think this is a little bit of the pot calling the kettle black. These states, Illinois, New York in particular, but some of the others that signed on to this brief, Maryland and Massachusetts, are not exactly paragons of clean streets. There are homeless people all over New York City subways and lying on the streets. Some of them aren't dangerous, but many of them are mentally ill, addicted to drugs, and do pose a public threat. And these cities have... Well, they'll say that they've tried to deal with these in numerous ways and tried to provide shelter, but it hasn't worked. And the same is true in California, which has undertaken perhaps the biggest experiment with this housing first policy that Governor Newsom has rolled out, which is basically you need to provide housing for anyone who's homeless. I mean, you can't attach any kinds of strings or conditions, which is what these other states argue in their amicus brief, is that, well, if only these cities provided, quote, housing first, and they didn't attach these difficult conditions or require them to stay sober or follow certain behavior rules, then they wouldn't have homeless problems, which is just hooey. Because if you look at California, it's done that. In fact, there was a state auditor report that came out a couple weeks ago that showed that the state has spent $24 billion basically on this housing first policy. And what has it gotten in result? Well, homelessness has increased by more than a third since 2013. And now, again, some of that is because of Prop 47, which decriminalized any kind of use of drugs and shoplifting and such, and made it easier for a lot of people to just stay out on the streets. But a lot of that, by the way, has also to do with this Ninth Circuit ruling that has made it harder for the city leaders to leverage any kind of criminal penalties or civil citations for lying on the streets or camping out on sidewalks, parks, or whatnot, and force them into treatment, as you first noted. This has been the housing first policy that Newsom and some other liberal states have championed. It has been a terrible failure. And we keep seeing that. And Santa Monica is now paying $1 million per housing unit to put up homeless people. They're spending billions of dollars when the real problem is, again, the incentives and the other policies that encourage homelessness.
Kim, do you think the writing is on the wall here, not only because of this coalition across the aisle in support of the city of Grants Pass here, but because we have a pretty textualist Supreme Court that is going to be looking at the actual words of the Eighth Amendment, and I doubt that they will find some sort of protection for public camping in it? I don't know about you.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think there's a number of reasons for it. Not just that they are textualists, not just a complexity argument, but I think that there was a creeping understanding here, too, that behind the push for this and the homeless advocates who are arguing this case. And you heard this word a lot in the oral arguments, was that they want to essentially create what they call a new status of people, which is the homeless community, and that that status provides you or requires that you be given certain things as a result, constitutionally, as it were. And I think that there's a wariness about that. You actually had John Roberts on the court said, are we really talking about a status here versus a situation of conduct? And there was a lot of discussion about the fact that this choice was involved in this. That does make things a little bit different than declaring a status on a certain sort of issues that truly are beyond their control. And there's an almost slippery slope argument here to be made that if you're going to go down the road of declaring a whole new status of a community and certain rights that they must be afforded, what else could you read into the Constitution that would also require government to provide certain things or give up all of its other ability to engage in public safety and other duties that it had? So I guess you can argue that that's a textualist reading, but also a concern about if you decide to abandon that textualism, where things lead and the chaos that could come.
Hang tight. We'll be right back after one more break.
WSJ Special Access gives you a front row seat to some of the Wall Street Journal's most exciting content, like The Quirkier Side of Life, a new series that features the fun, surprising stories our reporters come across.
The chief executive walks 10,000 barefoot steps every day. He recalls stepping on a bee, which put him off earthing for a couple of days, but he got back to it.
Check out The Quirkier Side of Life on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
Don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Let's turn to the oral argument at the court then on Tuesday. This was a case called Starbucks versus McKinney. And I gather that this has to do with whether the National Labor Relations Board gets a shortcut in federal court when it wants an injunction after a union complaint. And let's listen to a piece of the oral argument. This is Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson asking a question of Lisa Blatt, the lawyer arguing for Starbucks.
They have only asked for this kind of injunction in a very, very small number of cases. 20,000 complaints are filed with the board. 700 result in board action. And of those 700 that the board is investigating and doing and determining, they've asked for this kind of injunction 14 times. So, I mean, I appreciate that maybe the standards we need to look at, and I understand four factors versus two factors, but this is not sounding like a huge problem.
Well, restraint is not a basis for deference, and whether or not it's a huge problem, what petitioner wants is just a level playing field, the normal injunctive factors that agencies and private parties should get. So even if the board only sought one injunction, can you please hold that the four factors apply?
Alicia, what's your read of this case? And maybe the place to start is with, what was the complaint that was lodged against Starbucks?
So what happened here is this SEIU worker affiliate called Workers United has been seeking to unionize and organize a bunch of its stores across the country. And I would just point out, this is a pretty radical progressive union, and they've been pretty out front in terms of the anti-Israel protests. But that aside, what happened at Starbucks in Memphis, Tennessee, is six Starbucks employees announced their plans to unionize the store. And when the store is closed, these employees unlocked the door and let in a news crew, a local news crew, without the management's authorization to interview some workers to kind of draw attention to the union cause. Now, this essential break-in violated the company policy, and Starbucks fired several workers who were responsible. So what did the union do? Well, they filed a complaint with their friends at the NLRB and claimed that firing the workers constituted an unfair labor practice because they were retaliating against their right to engage in concerted activity. These NLRB regional directors are generally very sympathetic to the unions, issued an administrative complaint, and then petitioned a federal judge for an injunction ordering Starbucks to reinstate the employees and expunge an unrelated discipline citation for one of them, and among other things required that essentially would have hemmed Starbucks in various respects. And as it happens, the district court ruled in favor of the unions, actually, as typically happens, under a two-part test rather than the Supreme Court's traditional four-part test for seeking a preliminary injunction. And the standards that usually apply for almost every case, when a party seeks a preliminary injunction, you have to demonstrate that you're likely to succeed on the merits, that you will suffer irreparable harm in the absence of a preliminary relief, that the balance of equities tip in your favor, and then an injunction is in the public interest. Now, the Sixth Circuit, going back decades, set a more lenient standard for the NLRB and said that, well, the NLRB merely must show that there is reasonable cause to believe that unfair labor practices have occurred and injunctive relief is just and proper. Now, this, again, is far easier to meet for the NLRB than the four-part test. And really skews the equities or tips the scales in favor of the NLRB. So the district court judge deferred to the NLRB, and Starbucks ended up contesting this in an administrative proceeding that continues actually to this day, and actually also sought legal discovery to show that the NLRB was kind of acting in concert with the union. And what did the NLRB, or general counsel, do? Well, then she actually accused Starbucks of committing an unfair labor practice act by subpoenaing some records. And all this just goes to show how the due process rights of employers are really violated by this anomalous two-part standard that the Sixth Circuit has created.
And the importance of this is that if a lower standard allows union complaints to get easier junctions within the jurisdiction of the Sixth Circuit, that makes settlements and so forth much more likely, because it gives these labor unions more leverage against the employers that they're complaining about. And Kim, by the way, if this is a Sixth Circuit rule only, it seems like the Supreme Court is maybe overdue in stepping in and cleaning up what they call a circuit split, which is a different interpretation of the law that is reigning in one area of the country versus the rest of the country.
Yeah, absolutely. And one that has given the NLRB just way too much power, because what happens is essentially under this standard, the lower courts, when you have these, end up having to defer to the board allegations, even if those allegations are later contradicted. And injunctions also interfere with the kind of day-to-day operations of an employer's ability to do their work. They, you know, often they have to rehire back employees at expensive levels. And these things can stay in effect as well until the NLRB has time to fully adjudicate the case. And that can take absolutely years. And so what the NLRB does is uses these injunctions as a bludgeon against companies to get them to simply settle and not see the cases all the way through. And they actually brag about this. The agency does. I think half of all cases with injunctions since 2010 have resulted in settlements. And they're proud of that fact. They say, you know, injunctions are a strong catalyst for settlement. So it's clear that they're using them and abusing them. And this situation is giving them the power in certain situations to really beat on corporations in a way that just isn't allowed in some other places. So it would be great to put them in place, especially because there are dozens of other federal agencies that are required to follow the traditional injunctive relief standard. And there seems to be no reason whatsoever why the NLRB has this carve out in this one district.
Thank you, Kim and Alicia. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button, and we'll be back tomorrow with another edition of Potomac Watch.